I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The royal astronomer Martin Rees, eminent English voice of science in the world today, puts it this way. At 4.5 billion years old, our Earth has been around for 45 million centuries. And there's more than a chance, he says, that you and I are living in the very last one. Long odds, you say. But there's an academic discipline now and a global conversation built around the old apocalyptic fancy that events are converging toward the end.
I think what's important to realize is that this is the first century when we humans are really having a strong collective impact on the planet, because there are more of us, all empowered by much more powerful technology.
This is the fate of the Earth, the fate of other animals, the fate of plants, the fate of flowers.
I think that people want a day of doom. They want to think that there is a final moment of reckoning when everything is going to be different.
It's not the four horsemen exactly, pestilence, war, famine, and death from the last book of the Bible, but try these four. Man-made climate collapse, or maybe machine intelligence that is smarter than we are, or the human genome enhanced right out of its humanity, or finally, the ruin and rage that's all over the news, a failing human capacity to cope with circumstances. We are not talking about the Zika virus, for example, or the Donald and Hillary presidential race, or Brexit, or mass killings from Orlando to Nice, or the fact that pop media is one long parade of apocalypses.
We know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's.
3 billion human lives ended on August 29th, 1997. The survivors of the nuclear fire called the war Judgment Day.
You blew it up! God damn you all to hell!
Between the comic and the cosmic dimensions, we are listening for something like a rhyme or resonance with the anxieties of 2016.
Now imagine Donald Trump sitting in the Situation Room. Do we want his finger anywhere near the button?
4 more years of this stuff, and I'll tell you, we're not going to have a country left, believe me.
This is the first of 3 conversational takes on scientific and humanistic thinking about apocalypses. This hour, the downside of what is called, euphemistically perhaps, superintelligence. Here is that astronomer, Martin Rees.
We are in a world where we have technologies which are tremendously powerful for good and for evil. Of course, the first such technology was nuclear, which led to nuclear power, but of course more dramatically to nuclear weapons. And we've been under the threat of a nuclear exchange ever since the 1950s. But that's 20th century science. And I worry more even about the downsides of 21st century science, bio, cyber, and AI.
Martin Rees, I wish you'd bore in on the AI threat. We're talking here about existential risks that could destroy everything. Walk us through your own nightmares on that subject.
The development, particularly in the last 2 or 3 years, in what's called generalized machine learning, has been rather dramatic and is really a qualitative leap. The chess-playing IBM machine 20 years ago was programmed by experts to do just that job. In contrast, the machine developed by the British company DeepMind, which beat the world champion at the game of Go, was not programmed in the same way. It more or less taught itself by playing against itself and studying millions of games. And the people who programmed it don't themselves know how it made the decisions. And indeed, it beat the world champion by, in particular, making one move that baffled all the experts. They'd never seen a move like that. But that was an extremely clever move. And if these machines get more powerful, then those who own them and have access to them will, of course, have power. And that is a possible danger. What people worry about more than that, of course, is the possibility that these machines will sort of go rogue. And here again, if that happened, there would be worries, because the machines may have goals of their own, quite orthogonal to what we as humans want. And of course, unless they're very carefully programmed, then they may do unexpected things. I mean, the classic kind of example that's given is that you may have robots in your home which is supposed to make sure that your fridge is full and your meals are prepared, etc., and it does that fine. But if it's got no meat, it may put the cat in the oven, thinking that's a natural thing to do, because unless you program it carefully, it won't have these sort of common sense human responses which would stop us doing that sort of thing. And so we've got to ensure that when these advanced machines interact with the external world, that they either sort of learn ethical constraints from humans, or you've got to make sure you program them so that things which we know as it were, common sense, are fed into the program. So those are the dangers.
Dangers peculiar to the 21st century prompted ancient Oxford University in England to found a Future of Humanity Institute, where researchers grapple with degrees of disaster well beyond rising seas or earthquakes or famines. Their field is existential risk.
An existential risk is one that threatens the survival of Earth-originating intelligent life, or that threatens to permanently and drastically destroy the entire future. In a sense, an existential catastrophe would be one that would spell the end to the human story.
The Swedish-born philosopher Nick Bostrom founded the FHI and serves as head researcher. He, too, sees a problem in superintelligence.
The concern is not that, say, this future superintelligence would, like, enslave us or something, or resent our exploitation of it. The principal concern in that context is that it would be indifferent to human values. It would have other values.
Right.
And it then turns out that the most efficient way of implementing those values involves running roughshod over the human environment and human beings, like using our resources, maybe even the atoms in our bodies, for some different kind of construction that maximizes this different value. Much like we maybe want to build a parking lot outside a supermarket, perhaps there happens to be an ant colony living there, but we just pave it over. And it's not because we hate the ants. It's because they just don't factor into our utility function.
Right.
And so it's similar. Like if you have an AI whose utility function just doesn't value human well-being or human goals, then we might succumb as a side effect.
Nick Bostrom's colleague and fellow Swede, Anders Sandberg, works on artificial intelligence. He's a good-humored transhumanist, despite all the troubles on the horizon.
What is it about you Swedes? Is it the Volvos that make you worry about the apocalypse or the Bergman movies or what?
I'm much more cheerful than Bergman movies and Dark Winters would suggest. And I don't think it has to do with the pessimism. I think it has to do with this kind of almost utilitarian can-do attitude. Oh, we have a problem. There should be a solution. We should fix that.
Well, that's why people buy IKEA.
Hopefully, and hopefully we can make some kind of flat pack solution to the apocalypse.
We'll call it the Sandberg solution.
Yeah. So I would probably start something like, well, I have some good news and some bad news. The good news is that there is 88% chance that you will make it. So about 88% chance of hope and about 12% risk that we go extinct. Now, those numbers are to some extent total guesses. So they're not that important as numbers. It's more that, yeah, it looks like there is a noticeable risk that we might do ourselves in. But there is also a fairly large chance that we will make do and probably go to have a pretty glorious future.
I would say the first observation would be that the hope is the risk in many ways. The machine that will save us from machines could be a disaster.
Oh, yes. Any technology that's powerful enough to change the world is presumably also powerful enough to wreck the world in various ways.
Mm. What are the imminent dangers?
So right now, our main problem is human-caused risks, because natural disasters are pretty unlikely to do us all in. But nuclear war is definitely a possibility. And even if it's not terminal for our species, it would still probably destroy our current civilization and cause enormous setbacks. We're getting various manufacturing technologies, which means that individuals are going to be more powerful. So one crazy person might do even more damage than a current crazy person. And since there are a fair number of crazy people out there with strange motivations, there might be a great deal of trouble. You could also argue that there are long-term risks that we would stagnate or turn ourselves into something less than human. You can imagine, for example, computer games. If we perfect them so much that they're so much more interesting than reality, most people would never want to leave their virtual reality and would just be playing whatever comes beyond the World of Warcraft.
Be more particular about how AI superintelligence could be worse than nuclear weapons, say, as a man-made tool.
Nuclear weapons don't actually actively pursue you or have much creativity in how they try to hit you. The problem with artificial intelligence is that now we're making systems that are to some extent autonomous and that they are able to learn. So their behavior is not just prescribed by the code we put into them, but also things they encounter and which we might have no idea at all how to handle.
Andrews, come back to the bad news and the fear that drives all this exploration. Imagine for a moment you're an insurance actuary. What is the chance that this species can survive as we have known it?
I think the chance that humanity will survive as we have known it for a very long time is essentially zero. Because species do change. We adapt, we're both mutating genetically and we're selecting ourselves to some extent, but we're also developing technologies that change the way we live and technologies that allow ourselves to change ourselves. And it's pretty likely that we'll take up some of them before too long. At the same time, there are some risks, mainly, of course, threats to our survival, but also maybe we can develop in directions that we would objectively say, yeah, that's a bad thing. We don't want to evolve in that direction. But in the long run, this form of humans that we know today are not going to be around. Hopefully, something better is going to be around, and it's up to us to work to push in that direction.
Coming up, robots up close and almost personal, and a reminder that the nuclear age is not over. This is Open Source. In a summer series, we are listening hard to warnings of apocalypse, end times, engineered by geniuses of human science, now taking the form of man-made tools that could outsmart, outrun, or capture, or control, and in the end, destroy the species that made them. The nuclear physicist Robert Oppenheimer presided over the first round 70 years ago and wrote its epitaph after the atomic bombs were dropped from American planes on Hiroshima and Nagasaki to devastating effect. "We knew the world would not be the same," Oppenheimer said. He remembered a line from the Hindu Bhagavad Gita, the voice of Vishnu saying, I am become death,
the destroyer of worlds. I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
Elaine Scarry is a literary critic with a subspecialty in nuclear weapons. She argues that the American nuclear arsenal, radically modernized since the Cold War ended, more nearly owns us than we own it. I asked her if she worries about apocalypse.
I certainly worry about nuclear apocalypse. We right now have collectively over 15,000 nuclear weapons, and over 90% of them are owned by the United States and Russia.
We say we get through that crisis.
Oh, no, please. I mean, first of all, we've just agreed that we're going to spend $1 trillion to renew all these weapons. And many of them that are now existing were made after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Of our 14 Ohio-class submarines, each of which carries the equivalent of 4,000 Hiroshima blasts, so each of which can destroy a continent. And by the way, there are 7 continents on Earth and there are 14 Ohio-class submarines in the United States. 8 of them were made after the opening of the Berlin Wall. So 32,000 Hiroshima blasts have been put in place. And the idea that these are a holdover from the Cold War is just a deep and dark untruth.
Make what you will of the nuclear story as a lesson.
I think this question is best answered by an article Bill Joy wrote in the year 2000 in Wired magazine, where he proposed that someday our robots are going to carry out a revolution against us. And the article sounded like a wonderful, inventive piece of science fiction by somebody who's himself very steeped in the new technological, you know, cyber world and so forth. So not somebody who would be, you know, an alarmist Luddite or something. And here he was saying robots might be able to carry out a revolution. And it all sounded to me tremendously fantastic until he said the model for this is nuclear weapons, because they can eliminate us and we've convinced ourselves that we can't eliminate them. By the way, the idea that we can't eliminate them is preposterous, but it is a widely held view that they cannot be unmade. But in terms of getting rid of the killing apparatus that is in place, that weapons in the United States have assigned targets. Each weapon is already assigned a military target. Really, we have these weapons assigned locations?
Go back to the parable of nuclear weapons in two parts. First, the Manhattan Project, the Roosevelt administration, a world emergency, the yen to develop the super bomb, but then also the moment when it, you would say, it took over our democracy, our imaginations.
Well, I mean, certainly the scientists who invented it were trying to do something to defend our country. I think that as soon as they invented it, at least people like Oppenheimer clearly saw it as a disaster, terrible, terrible weapon to have in hand. One of the things about these weapons is that you don't actually see it from the receiving end of the injury. We think of the mushroom cloud. Mushroom cloud is what an atomic bomb looks like when you're outside it, when you're immune, when you're not on the receiving end. The survivors in Hiroshima, the Hibakusha, often say, we saw no mushroom cloud. That's not what it looks like when you're hit. But that carries us to a general problem, which is that when you see something from the making end, there's no question that there are acts of genius involved. That sabotages our ability to think about what these things are. The makers do call out for genuine respect because there were acts of genius involved. And the people who are working in other areas on the collider or on nanotechnology or on CRISPR or whatever are in many cases going to be incredibly brilliant people. You know, it's in part for that reason that only people who have somehow been on the firing end of the weapons are listened to. But the fate of the earth, the fate of other animals, the fate of plants, the fate of flowers, really, that doesn't have an equal claim? That the ordinary person on the street in any country doesn't have an equal right to self-defense? That is such a loss of the most basic political philosophy. The famous adage from Rosa Luxemburg, you only begin to feel your chains when you begin to move. When people begin to move, they're going to say, how could we have allowed this?
No, you can't shut it down, but what can you do?
You can say, we have on hand right now an architecture that threatens to destroy this truly incredible planet. Absolutely, we have that right now. And we're minutes away from it happening. We can undo it. It's simple to undo it. Just for the exercise of showing that you can undo something, which we can do. But you have to be ready. You have to get the procedures in place for how you back things up. This is our world. We don't have to just turn on the TV and find out whether the next person who gets elected thinks it's okay to torture, it's not okay to torture. No, these things are not up for your preference as a president. There are certain things that are off limits, and yet we've lost the ability to make that clear.
The bioscientists and the AI scientists have not had their Hiroshima. It helps in a certain way to have had 70 years and incredible casualties in the events themselves to force our thinking. Will it take a horrific event to show us the dangerous possibilities?
The unreality it has by having not yet happened gets confused with an unreality of its plausibility. And those two are not the same. These things are not only plausible, it's going to be a miracle if they don't happen.
Todd Lipson is on the cutting edge of the robot revolution. He is the director of the Creative Machines Lab at Columbia University. He worries about runaway machine intelligence, but on a very different track from nuclear weapons.
I think that nuclear weapons is not a good parallel to artificial intelligence because it's a very centralized technology. So a nuclear weapon is a singular thing that you own or you don't own, and it takes a lot of effort and a lot of technology to make one. And because of that, it was relatively easy to control. And you can have agreements about it, and you can detect it, and you can have treaties concerning it. But AI is the opposite. It's a distributed technology. It's just as powerful, but distributed. It's everywhere and it's nowhere. You cannot turn it off. You cannot find it. You cannot stop anybody from doing it. And again, in a way that's beautiful because lots of people can do lots of interesting things. They don't have to ask permission. It's very, very different than nuclear and any techniques and ideas we developed around controlling nuclear weapons are totally irrelevant in this new world.
Todd Lipson's mission at Columbia is to create machines that experience, learn, and react to the world as functionally living beings. For now, that means creating curious robots that can form theories from the observation of waves and pendulums. Down the line, Lipson says, it's a recipe for totally autonomous, self-replicating, super-intelligent machines.
What we're trying to do is create life out of matter. All roboticists are, at the end of the day, sort of a reincarnation of the old alchemist, but we're trying to understand what it is that makes something alive and trying to recreate, maybe not necessarily in biology, but to recreate those same fundamental principles that give life to biology.
How close are you, would you say, to created life and then intelligent life?
We're still pretty far. And when I say we, it's not just our lab, it's AI researchers and roboticists in general are still pretty far from creating something that somebody would walk up to and not be sure if it's alive or not. But I think we're getting closer pretty quickly because it's advancing at exponential rates, literally.
You've created a machine that can sort of take a lot of information and algorithms and run with the ball. Describe it.
So we've explored a couple of different approaches. One of them is this idea of a machine that actually formulates hypotheses based on the data that it sees and asks questions. It tries to sort of interact with the world and elucidate uncertainty. In other words, it's curious. It finds out what it needs to know. Hmm. So a little bit more than your usual system that just looks at data and finds out what there is to find out in that data, this system can actually ask questions. I'm seeing this incredible progress towards real intelligence.
Give us an example of the information that you hand your friend and then the questions that come back.
The classic example that started it all was we let the robot look at a double pendulum, sort of a swinging mechanical contraption, and the robot basically played around with that machine, asking questions, what happens if I put it this way? What happens if I put it that way? Mm-hmm. Let me see what happens when I put it upside down. So it interacts with the world and plays with it and gradually formulates a model that in retrospect we know is sort of the equivalent of a graduate degree in physics.
Tell me if I begin to get it. I mean, if you asked it, look at those ocean waves for 3 days and tell me what's going on, or say, read an electrocardiogram.
Exactly. But you also have to allow it to tinker with that system to sort of ask questions of its own. So it's not just sitting back and watching the ocean waves. It might actually want to dip in the water and see what happens. It actually wants to learn in an active way, not just in a passive way.
Go back to the electrocardiogram. I mean, there must be machines that read EKGs. Could your guy do it?
What we're finding out is that this idea of a system that learns in an active way, that asks questions, doesn't just look at data, can learn a lot faster, and it can learn simpler, more accurate models than an AI that just sits back and collects a lot of data and thinks about it. Now, can it answer any question? Probably not. But it gets us a little closer to what we think curiosity is in with humans. It's not just thinking about stuff. It's actually actively engaging with the world, asking questions, formulating hypotheses, refuting hypotheses, sort of asking the next question based on results from the previous one. There's a lot to it than just sitting in an armchair and thinking about the world.
We've been speaking with, shall we say, philosophical scientists, Nick Bostrom, for example, Andrew Sandberg, who sound at moments terribly worried that this sort of AI could be not just an inhuman, but a destructive force. And they're preoccupied with defending against it, building even smarter machines that will contain it, and the whole generation of machines that your guy could give birth to. I mean, deal with that threat problem.
I think that the danger is not what AI will do to people, but what people will do to people using AI. And that's much shorter term threat than any of these machines sort of putting the world out of work or rendering all humanity useless. The real threat is the concentration of power. What happens when a few companies, a few governments have access to this incredible technology and can use it for warfare, for surveillance, for censorship, for things like that?
You worry about concentration of control. Spell that out a little bit.
Imagine that this new form of AI, for example, deep learning is a new thing that everybody's talking about. An incredibly powerful form of neural networks that, for example, have a computer look at a picture of a man and a woman and tell which is a man and which is a woman. That's something that's trivial for humans. Computers could never do that reliably. Now it's a no-brainer. You can have computers look at pictures, listen to audio, and understand what's in the picture or what's in the audio better than a human. So these sorts of capabilities are sort of moving quickly. And with those capabilities, it doesn't take a lot of ingenuity to start thinking about things you can do with that. You can do a lot of interesting, useful things like precision agriculture, healthcare diagnostics for everybody. You can do all kinds of beautiful things, but you can also do nasty things. You can make surveillance that's just, you know, perfect and everywhere. You can make censorship that prevents you from seeing anything without any human having to be in the loop. You can make a sort of weapon of mass destruction, drones that look for certain people and kill them. The list goes on of bad ways that you can use this technology, and it's within reach.
The foreseeable future in this world is now something like, what, 6 months or 2 years. Take it a little further out, some of the things that the children of this machine might do.
Well, I would say let's try to think about things it couldn't do. That's really harder. Write content, books, radio podcasts, ask questions, interview, create new products and designs, paint art, certainly teach. My job is certainly on the line. Basically, anything that is even remotely repetitive, that is sort of well-defined and narrow, and that's sort of what most jobs are. The place where sort of a lot of this AI has trouble, not saying that it can't do it, but sort of would be last, are things that are very different every day. For example, something as mundane maybe as a plumber. I can't imagine a robot being a plumber, walking in, fixing things, finding out what's wrong every time, every place, it's a different issue. But something like, let's say, radiology, doctor looks at images and decides if there's a pathology there or not. That's on the chopping board tomorrow.
You say my career ends tonight. This is it.
I think what you're doing is a little bit more challenging than radiology, for example.
Radio more challenging than radiology. That's good. Hal Dibson, you said, in effect, you can't program rules into these machines. Could you imagine programming morality?
Well, a lot of these newer technologies, they learn. You can't literally put anything into it. You can only shape their experience and hope they learn the right thing. It's a little bit like teaching a child. How do you make sure a child learns the right thing, learns to be ethical and so forth, gets the right values? You can't program a human, but you can shape their experiences and hopefully they learn the right thing. And I think the same situation happens with these new AI machines. They learn from examples, and to the degree that we show them the right examples, they will learn the right thing. It's always going to be within sort of the confines of things we know and expect. But the moment we want to go to where we haven't been before, to come, we want machines to help us reach new heights, go places we haven't been before, we have to let go. In a way, it's again like raising a child. The most exciting moment is when your child knows more than you, when they can actually do things. And if you raise them right, they can go much further than you. And there's nothing more exciting than seeing that happen.
We keep hearing that machine intelligence, though it's still in its infancy, will one day run the show. It reminds you of Richard Brautigan's poem titled All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace.
I like to think, and the sooner the better, of a cybernetic meadow where mammals and computers live together in mutually programming harmony like pure water touching clear sky. I like to think, right now, please, of a cybernetic forest filled with pines and electronics where deer stroll peacefully past computers as if they were flowers with spinning blossoms. I like to think, it has to be, of a cybernetic ecology where we are free of our labors and joined back to nature, returned to our mammal brothers and sisters, and all watched over by machines of loving grace.
Coming up, three more free-thinking humanists contemplate a machine apocalypse. This is Open Source. For Uncommon Sense about machine intelligence, we gathered three writers and thinkers we like who look hard at technology. Nicholson Baker is the novelist of Vox and the pointillist historian of World War II in the book called Human Smoke. Maria Bustillos found her writing voice on the internet as a critic of film, tech, and culture, after the style and sensibility of the late David Foster Wallace. Finally, Mark O'Connell is an Irish book critic for Slate and a journalist who will publish a book next year called To Be a Machine. It's his own deep dive into cybernetics, cryogenics, and the enthusiasms that drive people like Nick Bostrom from the start of our show. Mark O'Connell has also written about the strange pathos of baby step robot videos online. All four of us together watched one such video from Boston Dynamics. It's called Pet Man Tests Camo. A man-sized robot in full camouflage suit walking and crouching awkwardly on a treadmill. Maria, Mark, Nick, you've all seen the Boston Dynamics model of Pet Man getting close to a humanoid, a cyborg. What do you see?
Yeah, I thought it looked like those funny little marionettes. There was a sort of adroitness and clumsiness. I found it kind of appealing in the fact that he had to have these wires from his neck because, you know, he was on the verge of falling over. And then the great moment.
A little drunk.
A little drunk, a little uncertain, and then he kind of leans forward in this awkward way, almost a bow, but not quite a bow, because he can't quite handle the displacement of center of gravity to make a bow. But I wasn't troubled by it. I didn't feel any horrors at all.
Mark O'Connell.
I certainly was troubled by it when I saw it first, but I'm not sure I was totally successful in figuring out for myself why I was so troubled. All I could think was that it was some kind of primeval fear of predation. I went to an event called the DARPA Robotics Challenge in LA last year. There was a competition where roboticists competed, sort of like an assault course almost, for their robots to complete various tasks, driving cars, getting out of cars, turning knobs, like very sort of basic, what would be for humans very easy tasks that are for robots incredibly complex and difficult. And I thought there was something strangely humanizing about the slapstick moments, the robots sort of falling out of cars and trying to do things and failing in this very human and sort of relatable way. And I found that my attitude towards these machines sort of changed and became almost weirdly tender because of that. It makes you realize how insanely complicated the things are that we take for granted, the sort of very simple movements that most of us can do unthinkingly, like opening doors and things.
That sounds like my feeling. I look at it and I say, it's a brilliant achievement, but it's nowhere remotely approaching the wisdom of a 3-year-old.
Right. So it's difficult to understand how we could be, on one hand, sort of terrified of these machines, you know, coming to get us and outsmarting us, and on the other hand, just looking at how far they are from being able to open doors and get out of cars effectively.
Maria?
It took Skynet 25 days to become sentient, you know, in the Terminator movies. Once they had turned it on, the Ultra machine became capable of defending itself against the human race, and when it saw the human race as a threat, then it destroyed us all. I think a lot of this is about the ghost in the machine, because we are ourselves ghosts in machines. Like, your body is a machine that you can operate. You feel your personality or your soul inside, I'm going to open this door. But like, when you watch a robot perform the same action, you have no sense of what the ghost is in that machine. The mystery of it can be creepy, frightening, or tender and endearing, because you're just anthropomorphizing. You can't help it.
Who among these three, I wanted to know, worried about the undoing of humanity?
One of the things that does kind of unsettle me, I don't know whether it's apocalyptic, but it's certainly economically apocalyptic, is the tide of automation that's coming our way. And it feels like the sort of internal logic of capitalism is always moving in that direction. So if you can own the means of production, that's obviously what you want to do. But if you can own the labor force as well, which is what automation technically is, then you've sort of won the game and everyone else has to go home. And that seems to me to be something that is increasingly a possibility. This is an apocalypse that appeals on a certain level to a very extreme sort of rationalist, to someone who believes that only reason can save us, that only reason can be our redemption. That's what appeals to Nick Bostrom and people who believe that artificial intelligence is this existential threat, that only sort of sufficiently working out the rational possibilities for this thing will save us from destruction. I'm not convinced that we are fully rational creatures. To get back to the current apocalypse that seems to be happening right now with the American election, reason doesn't seem to be coming into play all that much. You know, it's the old forms of apocalypse: war, economic stupidity and deprivation. I think those are the things we continue to be threatened by.
Nicholson Baker, you're my idea of a broad-spectrum humanist. Introduce yourself, your own head, on your apocalypse and when it arrives.
There's sort of a snobbery or a pecking order of apocalypses that I've noticed. So somebody is talking, let's say they're talking about climate change, and then somebody else says, yes, but what really worries me is, they get this sort of heavy-lidded superior look, and then they come up with, you know, the AI apocalypse or something. I think that people want a day of doom. They want to think that there is a final moment of reckoning when everything is going to be different. And the fact is that we're probably going to keep muddling along, making a lot of mistakes. There's not going to be a harrowing of hell. It's just going to be another day.
There is an apocalypse happening right now. Like, if you grew up in Syria, and every place that you grew up visiting and seeing has been destroyed your whole life. Like, you had a profession, you don't have it anymore. I mean, there are people who are living this thing. I mean, God knows what that must be like. What do you think of the world now? What do you think of history? What do you think of the future? I mean, it's not necessary for all of us to end for the apocalypse to be a meaningful idea ongoingly, unfortunately.
Mark, I'm fascinated by your exposure to these people we're talking to, Martin Rees or Nick Bostrom. It seems to me, listening to them, reading them, they're playing a sort of game with themselves. Invent the most incredibly threatening machine that they can imagine, and then invent a better one that will contain it, or somehow humanize it, or become godlike in strange ways. They're both offense and defense, and they're very extraordinary people.
For sure. I mean, Nick Bostrom is a really interesting sort of example of this kind of thinking, because as a younger philosopher, he was very much a figurehead of transhumanism, which is this notion that, you know, we need to push our relationship with technology forward as far as we can and sort of merge with machines and become immortal and upload our minds to computers and all these things. And he was very much, you know, a cheerleader for this stuff. And now, of course, he's a kind of an apocalyptic thinker in a way. There's this very extreme spectrum that goes on, and a lot of people within the transhumanist movement are sort of both extremely pro pushing technology as far as we can and merging with machines, and also very sort of vocal about the potential dangers of these things. But it seems to me to be almost like a kind of magical thinking. I describe it as magical rationalism, and this idea that reason can take us anywhere, that reason can get us to these almost sort of magical positions. I mean, the end point for artificial intelligence, if you listen to someone like Nick Bostrom, is that it will solve all our problems. If done correctly, there will literally be no technical or rational problems that we won't be able to solve. So we will have no disease, the problem of mortality will be solved, all these things be solvable by this superhuman intelligence. So it's either that or complete destruction.
This is where technology meets faith. This is where technology becomes a religion. It's either going to send you to heaven or hell. And it's very weirdly touching and strange that these rationalists who pique themselves so much on, you know, their value for empiricism and rationality have completely given themselves over to the religion of technology, to the point where they'll spend $250,000 to have their bodies frozen in hopes of being reanimated later.
Nick? It's always been true that there is an urge to leap forward. It's sort of that moment where you walk towards the edge of a cliff and you feel the all of humanity recedes, and suddenly, you know, you're in some Nietzschean moment of understanding everything, and it feels good. It's kind of a good feeling to be able to contemplate the clarifying ultimateness of this catastrophe. When I was 14, I was a big apocalyptician, if that's the word. I thought if the world ends, I thought that maybe oxygen would run out or something. But anyway, I was going to be one of the last survivors, and I was going to meet this girl who was also a survivor. And I thought, if we're the only people left, then we'll have a nice conversation. You know, I mean, there are all kinds of reasons why you might imagine the end of the world.
That was James Thurber's apocalypse, too. Everything ended and there's just a man and a woman together in a garden.
Isn't it kind of reassuring to imagine that the world won't succeed you, that you will witness the end and there'll be no more and you'll miss nothing? I think that's part of the appeal of apocalyptic thinking.
Poetic.
Before you all dismiss this thing as a literary conceit, I gotta say, it scares me. And for Martin Rees to say 45 million centuries and we just happen to be living in the last one, I immediately think of Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca saying, of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she had to walk into mine. Why did it happen to us to be at the end?
Do you really think that we're in the, I mean, we're in the last century in the technical sense that here we are. We're in the final century at the end of a lot of centuries. I have a very calm feeling that there are more centuries to come. I mean, I'm looking forward to thinking my way forward, even though I won't be around.
That's why we love you, Nick. Speak, all three of you, please, to Elaine Scarry's point that, no, we've been living with an apocalypse, a man-made, end-of-everything machine called nuclear weaponry for 70 years now. She says, don't worry about AI. The nuclear Armageddon could be tomorrow.
Feynman had a really interesting thing to say about that. He was at the Trinity test of the first bomb. And he was this very sunshiny physicist who some years later became kind of depressed and imagined New York City being destroyed. Like, he thought it was inevitable. Why are these people bothering to build buildings? But then he decided, I can only live my own life. I think it's really good advice. I mean, why aren't we dead already? It's been 70 years. Why hasn't there been a gigantic nuclear holocaust? It's actually surprising, considering how dumb people are and how full of rage and craziness.
I agree. 70 years went by and we figured out how to avoid that because we're not as stupid as people think we are. And we realized that we don't want to destroy our world. And so we didn't blow ourselves up.
I have to introduce the God piece of this because it seems to me there's an inescapable human impulse to imagine the horrific end of things. There's also an equal and opposite impulse to invent the cure for these things. We're not just playing God with the universe. We're inventing a new God, a better God. And these guys like Bostrom and others are preoccupied with making sure that the new God has all of our values, our corrective impulses in it.
Isn't that a kind of fascinating preoccupation that the old God is dead, but we're going to make a better one?
I don't know if it's the best use of their time, though. I don't know anything about apocalypses, so I said to my wife, what is this all about? And she said the Puritans were great believers in the apocalypse. That's why they came here. And I looked it up, and the best-selling book in the United States for years, decades, was this book called The Day of Doom. It sounds a little bit like 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, except instead of Christmas, it's hell on earth. It's Christ appears and all the bad people are tortured and made miserable in various ways. And it goes on and on and on. And surviving copies are so thumbed because people read them so carefully and thought about how bad things would be when the apocalypse happened that they read the book to pieces. So there's obviously an appetite for that.
That's true. I think there's like a frisson of pleasure to that level of terror. I think that's what draws us to it, that there's a kind of a death drive sort of level of pleasure involved.
The royal astronomer, Martin Rees, gets the last words as he had the first. Devoted though he is to the pale blue dot of Earth, he's reminding us that our planet, our people, are far from the end of the story.
If we think of the timeline for what's happened on Earth, then it's taken 4 billion years for intelligence to evolve and technology to evolve, and we've had that for a few thousand years at most. But then, as we've discussed, it's quite likely that the machines will become more intelligent than humans within a few centuries, if not sooner. But then they will have billions of years ahead. So if you think of the timeline stretching into the future as well as in the past, then there's 4 billion years when there's nothing detectable. Then there's a few tens of centuries when there's a civilization like us. But then there are billions of years when there'd be these post-human entities, probably not on the Earth, but away from it, roaming interstellar space. Most educated people are aware that we are the outcome of 4 billion years of evolution from the simplest life in the young Earth, and they're happy with that. But I think most people who are familiar with evolution nonetheless somehow think that we humans are the end of a story. We're the culmination of it all. No astronomer could believe that, because we as astronomers know that the Earth is less than halfway through its life. The sun's been shining for 4.5 billion years, but it's about another 6 billion before it runs out of fuel and dies. So there's a huge potential for future evolution here on Earth and far beyond. So we should see ourselves as maybe not even the halfway stage in evolution. And we can strengthen that statement, because if we ask what's going to happen in the future, then I think what's probably going to happen is that within a century or so, there will be small communities living away from the Earth, maybe on Mars, maybe in space. Within a few centuries, they will be a new species. That'll be the start of the post-human era. And then we can imagine, if they extend their lifespan to thousands or millions of years, then interstellar travel would not be daunting to them. And so that'll be the start of a spread through the galaxy. And so there will be this future evolution, not just on Earth, but primarily far beyond the Earth. And it'll happen on a faster timescale than Darwinian selection, where it takes about 1 million years for a species to evolve. It'll happen on a timescale of technology. So that's why in the far future there could be far more evolution than has been up till now. So we are nearer the beginning than the end. So that is a perspective which I think astronomers give, that our pale blue dot is perhaps a special place, but even if there's no life out there already in the universe, our Earth may be the place which is the seed from which life can spread through the galaxy and beyond.
Next time on Open Source, part two in our apocalypse series, we'll get into genetic modification, risks and rewards of amendments or enhancements, as they say, to the human genome, not least to get our offspring ready for life on Mars. Thank you, Martin Rees, Nick Bostrom, Anders Sandberg, Elaine Scarry, Hod Lipson, Maria Bustillos, Mark O'Connell, and Nicholson Baker. Our show is produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, and Frank Horton. Superintelligence is all of them. George Hicks is our master mixer and technologist. Mary McGrath is our favorite cyborg. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.